Same-sex marriage has been legal across the United States since 2015, but child custody disputes can be complicated for same-sex couples who had children and split up before they could legally marry. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll talk about a case before the Ohio Supreme Court. Along with a push to tighten up the rules for citizen-led petitions in Ohio, what Kentucky's senior senator says about President Trump's trade policies, and the proposed memorandum of understanding between Hamilton County and the Bengals to start renovations at Paycor Stadium. Joining me now to get our weekly news review started is Cleveland.com Statehouse reporter Anna Staver. Welcome back, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you here. Tell us about the couple at the center of this Ohio Supreme Court case that relates to custody.
So it's two women from Hamilton County, and they were together from 2003 to 2015. They had three children, and one woman, Priya Shahani, carried all three children. So Shahani is the biological mom. However, they chose a sperm donor matching the ethnicity of Carmen Edmonds, the other parent. And then they broke up. They never got married. And Shahani now would like sole custody of the children, saying Edmonds is not biological. They have a shared custody and visitation agreement, but Edmonds really wants parental rights, saying a parent has access to medical records, a parent has access to school records. Ms. Shahani has now married somebody else, and Edmonds says that she might not be able to stop that partner from adopting what she considers to be her children. And so this case has ultimately worked its way up to the state Supreme Court because it hinges on this very interesting question of, would they have married if they could have married? And what standards should Ohio use for evaluating if they would have married? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. What was the custody agreement when the relationship ended between the two women?
So there are three children, and one is a set of twins and the other is an older child. And the older child, they had a shared custody agreement. It appears they did not have a clear shared custody agreement for the two younger children. And so then Ms. Shahani went and they had a hyphenated name originally. So then Ms. Shahani went and took Edmonds's last name off the hyphenated name for the two younger children. And it seems to really focus on the fact that there was no shared custody agreement for the twins.
When did that happen? When did the biological mother decide to take the other person's name off? I mean, when did this start to kind of fall apart?
So the relationship ended in 2015 when Edmonds says that Shahani had an affair with their nanny and left her. So it's a very contentious separation. And between 2017 and 2018, they started to have custody, they started to have visitation, they didn't. It's not a divorce, right? But it's one of those nasty breakups where both sides is accusing the other of misconduct. And it just, it got ugly, as sometimes relationship breakups do, no matter what gender is involved.
Right. What's the legal question at the center of this case? The two women, as we talked about at the top of this interview, were together before the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2015 that legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. So what's kind of the legal question at the heart of this?
So Ohio does not recognize common law marriages, and it doesn't recognize it for anybody, gay, straight, whatever. And we also had a law that said you have to be married to adopt your spouse's children. So because they weren't married and Ohio didn't recognize common law marriage, Ms. Edmonds could never adopt the children. And Obergefell, which is that 2015 case, says if you were denied a right because you were gay, then you have a right to seek retroactive relief. Basically, if you would have married, now you can go ask for those benefits. And this is the real question. So would Shahani and Edmonds have gotten married but for the law in Ohio banning it? Ms. Edmonds says yes. She says, I proposed. She says we had a commitment ceremony. She said, we hyphenated the names. We had a baby shower where we both wore mother-to-be sashes. We always intended to be co-parents. Ms. Shahani disputes some of these claims. She says they didn't have a commitment ceremony. She says she never would have married Ms. Shahani, I mean, Ms. Edmonds. So they're really disputing the facts. And this really hinges on like, how could a court basically determine who is telling the truth here?
Well, and this is at the Ohio Supreme Court now, so it's gone through other courts. What have the lower courts ruled in this case?
So the trial court gave custody to Ms. Shahani, to the biological mother. But the district court reversed that. And so now it's about setting a standard for these, because actually, when the case had oral arguments this week, there was a number of non-biological parents in the courtroom who were there to support Ms. Edmonds, saying they're tied up in similar custody cases, which is probably why the state Supreme Court has taken this, because there's a number of cases where there's this custodial dispute between these couples. And it could have pretty big impact because the Ms. Shahani's attorneys are saying you need to have gotten married in another state. You need to have applied and been rejected for a marriage license. You need like tangible legal documentation of a harm in order to seek, oh, what's the word? Relief from that harm. On the other side, the non-biological parent is saying it should be clear and convincing, right? If there is clear and convincing evidence that they would have gotten married, then that should be enough. And, you know, it's fascinating to think like, how do we determine what makes a parent in this situation? Because custody is whatever best for the kid. So, you know, Miss Edmonds has custody of partial custody of these kids. She has visitation rights, but it's the difference between custody versus parental rights.
Huh. You mentioned before that one of the questions at the center of all this is, would this couple have gotten married if that had been legal when they were together? My understanding is the First District Court of Appeals ruled that the trial court should have determined the answer to that question, would they have gotten married if it had been legal? But how can a court determine that?
This is one of those questions. So Justice Pat DeWine, that one of the Ohio Supreme Court justices, asked whether this is sort of impossible for a court to do, to look at whether they would have gotten married. And that's what the attorney for the biological mother is saying. They like you're trying to shoehorn a marriage into a relationship, is what he said.
Huh. Were there other questions that any of the other justices brought up? I guess I wonder, could you get any sense for what they were thinking as they heard arguments in this case?
Oh goodness, that's always dangerous. But yeah, Pat DeWine said, how could a court really sort this out? Because no one knows what somebody would have done. So that seems to be maybe where he's coming down, but you never want to assume that the question isn't them playing devil's advocate. We had questions from Justice Fisher about whether this would really matter because Miss Edmonds, the non-biological parent, does have custodial rights. She has visitation rights. And so would anything about the day-to-day lives of these kids change? There was another really interesting question about whether the well-being of the children, like what's best for the kids, should factor into their decision as a Supreme Court.
You mentioned that there were other people in the courtroom who are, parents, maybe not biological parents, or they feel like they want a parental relationship with a child and they're watching this closely. Can you talk a little bit more about that, what this decision could mean to other families?
Yeah, because we don't have common law marriage and because there was no legal path to adoption, essentially you end up in this complicated situation in, you know, gay relationships where one person may be the biological parent and the other one essentially is relying on the good faith of the biological parent. And, you know, in Miss Edmonds' case, what she says is, I was there from the day these children were born. They're now, I believe, the twins are 8 and the older child is 10. And her opinion is I've raised these kids, I did the diapers, I was up with the fevers and the school and the care, like I am their mother and they believe me to be their mother. And she feels very personally devastated at the idea of being cut out.
When is a decision expected in this case?
It'll happen in the coming months, so I would suspect probably like By the end of summer, we'll probably get an answer.
Well, let's talk about some new rules that are being proposed for how citizen-led issues get on the ballot in Ohio. What are some of the big changes in this bill proposing these new rules?
Yeah, so this is a sweeping election bill, not education. A sweeping election bill in the Senate. And one of the big change, it does a lot of different things, but what I really focused on and what we're talking about is how petitions gather enough signatures to get on the ballot. So if you want to go either to change a law or to change the constitution in Ohio, you're going to need hundreds of thousands of signatures from all 88 counties, right? And so this is how do we go about collecting them? And so what this bill would say is if you pay somebody to collect those signatures, if they're not a volunteer, then they have to wear a visible badge while collecting that designates them as a paid signature gatherer. And the Republicans pushing it say that you should know whether it's your neighbor or some professional signature gatherer. They're sort of saying it would weed out like outside interests trying to change Ohio's constitution versus like a homegrown effort. And then it also would tighten the rules for the paperwork that these all circulators have to fill out. It would make them sign something saying that they understand that they could be subpoenaed and have to present evidence. It also creates a whole new list of things where petitions could be thrown out, like if the circulators don't wear the badges, if they sign the wrong sections of forms, if paperwork isn't filled out correctly. So it creates a whole new framework for them, essentially.
It's not easy to get a measure on the ballot now, is it? I mean, what are
No.
the.
And this is sort of the dirty little secret. Even if it is something that, say, the overwhelming majority of Ohioans want, getting enough signatures to qualify for the ballot is next to impossible without paying people. Most ballot initiatives use paid circulators because it's just hundreds of thousands of signatures. You have a requirement to get a certain number from all 88 counties. They also have to be valid registered voters, and their address has to match where they're voting. So it gets like if somebody has moved and hasn't updated their voter registration data, like that can knock off a signature. You usually need many, like the bar is like 400-ish thousand signatures right now, and you usually need to get like at least 600,000 or more to qualify. So voting rights groups say, look, it's already very hard. And they think that putting these badges on will be more like a scarlet letter as a way to try to encourage Ohioans not to sign these petitions. And then their second problem is really interesting, is how we define paid. So this law defines it as given or promised or received any money or other thing of value. And this is where the voting rights groups have issues because is a t-shirt a thing of value? Is a free pizza a thing of value? Is like water and granola bars a thing of value? So like if your volunteers get those things, are they therefore a paid circulator?
Wow. Well, progressive groups have had some big wins at the polls in Ohio in recent years. I'm thinking the ballot issues on abortion rights and adult use cannabis. Are these proposed changes a reaction to that at all?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Right? So the like Common Cause Ohio and the League of Women Voters both say, yeah, they see a through line between ballot success and then a tightening of the rules to get on the ballot. They also point to, as I'm sure listeners remember, in August of 2023, we had that Republican pushed idea to make it harder to amend the state constitution to sort of raise the bar for what passes as an amendment. And so their argument is, yeah, the more we have success at the ballot box, the more Republicans in the legislature want to tighten this down. Now, the Republicans pushing this say no, and also they have issues with the amount of out-of-state money that flows into these initiatives. One of them that they pointed to was like casino gambling, right? The casinos invested a ton of money getting this on the ballot and tried, a number of different times to draft things that would have benefited them in different ways. They even pointed to the redistricting amendment. It got a lot of out-of-state funding, and they are trying to make the case that maybe it wouldn't have made it on the ballot were it not for paid petition signature gatherers. And it's really, it's fascinating to see them talk about the same set of facts in such a different way.
One of the things that you reported that I thought was so interesting is that a lot of these signature campaigns also register people to vote if they're not already registered. Would this bill have an impact on that?
Yeah, because you think about it, right? You're out at these festivals, right? If you go out to like a farmer's market or a festival or some sort of event, you've probably seen paid signature gatherers, right? Going through and being like, would you like to sign for this bill, put it on the ballot? And a lot of times they run into people who aren't registered to vote. So traditionally they would offer them voter registration. And the current law says, as long as they are registered at the correct address on the date that you turn your all of your signatures in, they are good to go. So you could help them change their address. You could help them get registered to vote, and then they could sign it. It's like a one-stop shop. Huh. The proposed law would be they have to be registered at their current address the day they sign the petition. And so what that would mean is if they aren't registered to vote, they could fill out the voter registration form. You could help them get that turned in, but then you'd have to go find them like a week or 2 weeks later and have them sign it just to be sure that their board of election had processed their registration.
Oh, so it takes some time for that to be processed.
Yeah, Common Cause said that is highly improbable, right? Like, you're going to track somebody down that you met at a farmer's market 2 weeks later to make sure they sign the petition.
Yeah. What's the argument for that? Why do supporters say, hey, we need to make that change?
Andrew Brenner, Senator Andrew Brenner, says that it's about having skin in the game. Like, he sort of questioned why someone who isn't registered to vote should be signing a ballot initiative in the first place. And it's to them, it's about making sure that like people who are like getting on board are getting on board and are already involved in the process.
Huh. Where does this legislation stand? Is this a priority for lawmakers?
Right now, I think the budget is the big priority for lawmakers.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then they have to do redistricting because constitutionally we have to get those lines done by the fall. And so I think those two things are going to suck up most of the oxygen at the state house. This is moving forward. It's had a couple of hearings, but I will say President Donald Trump's administration, do you remember? Time sort of mushes together for me, but it was like just a couple of weeks ago, I think, that the Trump administration issued that long memo on elections and what they wanted to see from states on elections. And so conservatives are sort of saying, like, this is what the president wants, you know, and this aligns with the Trump administration's request. So it adds a little bit of urgency to the situation, at least for them. Hmm.
Well, I've been talking with Cleveland.com State House reporter Anna Staver. Thank you so much for your time today, Anna. Always great to talk with you.
Thank you. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Up next, we discuss Senator Mitch McConnell's take on the Trump administration's tariffs. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was in town Thursday and offered a blunt assessment of the Trump administration's trade policies.
It's important for everyone to understand that a trade war is ultimately paid for by taxpayers, by regular voters.
Joining me now to talk about the senator's take and some of his other reporting this week is WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey, Lucy. How's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for being here. Who did Senator Mitch McConnell meet with Thursday in Northern Kentucky?
Senator McConnell met with Northern Kentucky business leaders and the CEO of the CBG Airport to talk about the impact tariffs were having on business in Northern Kentucky specifically.
And what we heard a little bit about what he said about how, hey, tariffs are taxes. What generally did he have to say about the Trump administration's policies after he met with those business leaders?
He basically, his message was, we need to rethink this. He literally said at one point, Mr. President, there's got to be a better way to do this. He didn't, I'm paraphrasing. He didn't literally say that, but that was pretty close. He's saying this is hurting people. This is hurting consumers. It's hurting businesses.
Yeah. Senator McConnell also hearkened to the past.
We've seen this in history unfold in a way that did not work for us or for other countries. And there's some of us who think, Mr. President, why don't we try something different? I'm very much in favor of extending the 2017 tax bill, for example.
How did his comments that he made Thursday compare to what he has said earlier about these tariffs?
Well, I think he's coming down a little bit harder than he has in the past, even recent past. Just a few days ago, I think it was April 21st, he said, jury's still out. I'm waiting to see how these impact people. But the way the quote reads, it's like he's pretty skeptical even then. But now he's just coming out and saying, like, this is bad.
Yeah. What did you hear from the business people who met with Senator McConnell?
So there were a couple folks who run businesses in Northern Kentucky. Rick Ross is the CEO of Gallery Candy and Gifts. And then another CEO there was, or actually, sorry, President Richard Fields of Post Glover Resistors. They make like electrical components. They both said, like, look, we have all these contracts with big vendors or big customers who are, well, with both the vendors and the customers, who are locked in on this certain price, and now the price is way higher. Meanwhile, we're wondering what's going to happen in the next week because the tariffs could be rolled back. They could be increased. These are companies that are looking to expand. They're companies that generally, they say, do pretty well, and now they're, you know, holding off on expansions, really rethinking their business entirely.
Did Senator McConnell share any thoughts about what Congress could or should do about this? I mean, what kind of authority does he say Congress has in all this?
I found this really interesting because McConnell says, our hands are tied. Congress can't do anything. This is the realm of the president. He is within his powers to do all this. Then he turns around and suggests there are people who think maybe we should rethink that. Maybe there's some way Congress can rework that and get some power back to kind of rein in tariffs. He didn't go into a whole lot of depth about that, but that was kind of what he was going toward.
Ah, interesting. Well, I want to switch to another more news that you covered this week, and that is this change that some Ohio lawmakers want to make about how county coroners are selected. Explain what that's about.
Yeah, so right now in 86 of 88 Ohio counties, including Hamilton County, the whole southwestern Ohio region, coroners are elected. There's an election every 4 years. You choose your coroner as a voter. That's not how it works in every state. Ohio's one of about 20 states that has elected county coroners. 23 others have what they call medical examiners who are appointed. Lawmakers in Ohio want to change that. They want to go to this medical examiner system, although they're still saying they're going to appoint county coroners, which, you know, I think the difference is maybe semantic. But they want the county commissioners in each county to do that. This was put in the Ohio budget bill, and so this is kind of a relatively new development in terms of the legislation, but that's kind of the gist of it.
What's the argument in favor of making the coroner an appointed position instead of an elected position?
So what lawmakers are saying basically is that it's expensive to run elections, but on top of that, they're like, look, this is kind of already how it works in these rural counties where there just aren't people running for a coroner. And also, this is kind of already happening in a way because a lot of these smaller counties, they're outsourcing their death examinations and some of the other things they're doing to larger counties. Hamilton County does a lot of work for, like, say, Claremont County in terms of that, and other counties too. And so they're saying, like, we're just recognizing what's already happening. You know, there aren't enough people who want to be coroners in every county and are, you know, like, able to do that job. So we need to come up with a new system.
You talked to several local coroners who oppose the idea. Talk to us about who's against the plan and why they say they oppose that idea.
You know, earlier this week, the coroners in Butler County, Claremont County, Hamilton County, and also in Warren County held a news conference where they kind of released this letter saying, like, this is a bad idea, and here's why we think it's a bad idea. Highland County coroner also signed on to that letter but wasn't at the news conference. And what they're saying is, why would you introduce more politics into a system that doesn't need it? You know, right now, it's based on science. The voters choose who they want, and that's it. But if you have some, you know, somebody appointing a coroner, that person could then be somehow influenced by the person that, or people that are appointing him.
You know, there are some people who would look at a position like the coroner's position and say, hey, a death examination should not be political. Signing a death certificate shouldn't be a political kind of thing. Are there particular types of cases that these coroners who had this news conference are most concerned about where they think politics could be inserted into the process?
Sure. I think any case where the outcome is sensitive socially or politically, that could be a high profile suicide. It could be a murder, but it could also be like death in custody. Hamilton County Coroner Lakshmi Samarko mentioned this. Like, there are a lot of deaths in custody of law enforcement. And who do you want investigating that? Do you want the people who might be appointed by the county commission that oversees the sheriff's office to be responsible for that? Or do you want somebody that you chose? You know, and so that's kind of their point.
What, and you kind of mentioned that, you know, in some states they use medical examiners, some states they use, we have coroners, elected coroners. What's the difference between those two?
So the medical examiners are usually forensic pathologists. So they're a little bit more tightly focused on that sort of area of the medical world. In Ohio, the elected county coroners have to be licensed physicians. So they're at least in the medical world. In other states, it's not like that at all. It's completely just whoever you elect for coroner, that's the person. In Ohio, there has to be some, you know, like qualifications. But generally, the medical examiners are more tightly focused on that that sort of forensic pathology kind of world.
If this proposal does become state law, when would these changes take effect?
So you wouldn't really see the rubber hitting the road on this until elections in 2029. Elections in 2028 for 2029. So
okay.
January 2029, my
okay.
bad. Yeah.
No, that's good to know. Well, you've had a very busy week. You also have an update for us on Vision and Beyond. We've talked about Vision and Beyond on the show before, but this is a cruel question, but can you give us kind of a brief synopsis for people who aren't familiar what Vision and Beyond is and what the problems have been?
Sure. Vision and Beyond was a company that owned 70 apartment buildings in Cincinnati. We're talking maybe about 1,000 tenants. There was a complex fraud scheme that is alleged to have happened. Vision and Beyond basically abandoned those properties and left tenants without any sort of property management. Folks were struggling with ceilings collapsing, water leaks, that kind of thing. Since that time, the properties have been put into a series of receiverships. The latest receiver has been there about 2 months. Tenants are saying, we still have all these problems. They had a news conference this week where they said, we're making a tenants union and we're going to be doing all these things to kind of push you to solve some of these issues. They marched up into the office of the property manager, read their petition out loud, read their letter out loud, and then left it on the desk and then marched back out.
Wow. What kind of problems are people still having?
There's a lot of ceilings collapsing. I've seen a lot of photos and videos of ceilings that are caving in. Still a lot of leaks, some flooding. One building in particular I went to in East Price Hill, the water is going to be shut off because there's, you know, this dispute about who owns the building. And so the owner pays the water. Nobody's paying the water because nobody knows who the owner is. So they're going to be without water at the end of the month if there's not some solution.
That's got to be a health problem. I mean, you have to have water to be able to live in a place, right?
That's one of the factors that can make a building condemned if you can't run water to it.
Yeah. What is what do the property managers say about this? The receivers who are, you know, these tenants are complaining about.
So Prodigy Property Management has been on the job for 2 months now. And they say, like, listen, we're trying to do the best we can. We spend about $20,000 of our own money. That's what we can afford. In the meantime, it's the owners under this receivership scheme that have to pay for these repairs. And the owner, the owners, if we know who they are saying, like, we're not paying yet. This whole thing hasn't been sorted out. We don't know who's who yet and who actually owns these buildings. So that's a big, big problem.
Yeah, no kidding. So the owners are supposed to pay, but who owns what is in dispute. And does that just leave the tenants? Like, where does that leave them?
That's the question right now. You know, in some cases, there are people who are saying, we are the investors, we own this property, but we don't want to pay anything until we see a really detailed plan about what it is. Prodigy has tried to take out a loan to get these things done, and that's caught up in dispute legally too. So really, it's hard to know what's going to happen with these folks who live in these buildings at this moment.
How will a tenants' union help them in this situation, or how do they believe it will help them?
They believe that by acting together and putting all of their rents in escrow, it's going to just force something to happen, because the cash flow coming in from their rents is important to everybody involved, really, like the investors, to the receiver. So they're saying, like, listen, we're not paying to live in a place that we can't really live in, that isn't habitable. So that's right. Their contention.
Yeah. Is there a risk? I mean, we talked about how one of these properties, the water could be shut off, and that makes it's not habitable if the water shut off. Is there a risk that some of these properties could be condemned? I mean, are tenants worried about that?
This is something that I'm trying to wrap my head around, too. It's like the city is both involved in this legal battle, trying to get the receiver in place, but then also the city is tasked with making sure buildings are safe and habitable, and some of these buildings are getting to the point where maybe they're not. So, you know, I can't really speculate on what that solution looks like, but that's definitely part of the tension, right, is these buildings are not getting any better.
Yeah. So what's next with this, Nick? What are you watching for?
So Monday there's another hearing involving the some of the myriad legal issues. I'll be going to that to kind of see how things are getting unwound. This is what they call complex litigation, so it could take a long time. In the meantime, one of the co-founders of Vision and Beyond was arrested in Houston last month, and I've seen some legal documents that they won't actually indict him until May, because they're trying to make some kind of sort of like a plea deal with him before indictment. And so I'm waiting to see what that looks like and what will happen with that person.
A lot of moving parts with this. I'm glad you're covering it. I've been talking with WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you so much for your time today, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy. Always fun.
Up next, we'll break down the proposed memorandum of understanding between Hamilton County and the Bengals concerning Paycor Stadium. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Hamilton County officials this week announced a new memorandum of understanding with the Bengals that lays out a plan to begin renovations at Paycor Stadium. Joining me now to break down that proposal and talk about who will be footing the bill are WCPO9 I-Team reporters Paula Christian and Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan and Paula.
Hi, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Paula, explain the proposal that was presented to Hamilton County Commissioners. What kind of stadium upgrades are part of the deal, and what's the total cost of the whole thing?
Well, the total cost is $184 million, and it's just the first phase of stadium renovations that will ultimately cost more than $800 million.
What would be in this first phase? I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. So in the first phase is escalators, elevators, stairs, a new Jumbo Vision control room. That's what the county would pay for. The team would pay for things like new suites, new lounges, more beautifications to the stadium, some fixes to the entranceways and how fans get in and out of the stadium.
Okay. Dan, what does this proposal say about how much the county will pay and how much the Bengals and the NFL will pay for this first phase?
The most recent document, the MOU, describes an arrangement where the team and the county and the state would pay roughly equal amounts of what they're now saying is an $830 million renovation project that would last until 2029. So that's basically what the county has asked for. They've asked for a little bit more than a third. They've asked for, I think, 42% of the total with their $350 million request that went to the House late last month.
Okay, but for this first phase, this $184 million phase of upgrades, isn't there a breakdown that includes the county, the team, and the NFL? How does that break down?
No, right now, I think what they're talking about is a $64 million contribution from the County, $120 million from the NFL and the team. And the team would contribute $60 million. They'd be matched by a $60 million loan from the NFL. But they don't include at this point any state contribution for that. What the document says is that they're going to work toward this more comprehensive agreement covering the full 830, and that if they can't get what they want from the state or from each other as they proceed, either party has the ability to walk away from the deal.
Okay. Well, and I do want to talk about this bigger project, the $830 million or whatever it is for the whole thing, but I want to hone in on this first piece, these initial upgrades first. Paula, it sounds to me from reading the reporting that you and Dan did that the county is still putting in more money than the Bengals, maybe, because the money the Bengals will pay the NFL to repay this loan is money the team would have paid the NFL anyway. Is that right?
That's our understanding. And I mean, this is the reason that all of this is happening now and that they put it together kind of at the last minute is the state legislature is meeting now on this budget. They have given the Cleveland Browns $600 million in bonds for a new stadium. The House already passed that. Now it's in the Senate. Now the Bengals and Hamilton County are trying to put forward an ask for their money for $350 million. And FC Cincinnati is asking for money. So they put this plan together, which the commissioners will, this MOU will be voting on Tuesday, to make sure they have something concrete in front of the state before they start like really doling out the money for good on these stadiums, because they want some. So some of what they're, this MOU is kind of fluid at this point. You know, the first phase is laid out, but there's a lot of wiggle room. If the state doesn't give them money or things, you know, don't go how they want, none of these renovations could happen.
So, Dan, what does that mean? I mean, that there was a big announcement when this MOU was unveiled earlier this week. Paula just explained that part of this is an effort to, you know, get this state money. But is this an indication that the team and county are on track to reach a lease agreement? I mean, that's kind of the big end goal of all this, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's probably true. They're, you know, this is the first time they've agreed on a dollar amount for what they want to build and a sort of a collection of things that they want to tackle with this renovation. But they have not addressed in this document whether the Bengals will pay rent in the future. They haven't addressed how long the contract will be extended. Will it be a new lease? Will it be an extension of the existing lease that began in 1997? And there's other issues that really have not been addressed that, you know, have come up over time as to things that the county might want from the Bengals. The county might want more ability to have control in developing the banks. There are elements of the Bengals lease that restrict the county's ability to build above a certain height, or, you know, in the past they've had to protect parking spaces for the Bengals and weren't able to develop certain lots. So there's a lot of elements that aren't addressed in this MOU that would have to be addressed in the comprehensive agreement. But the document lays out that they want it accomplish that comprehensive agreement by June of this year.
Paula, you mentioned that the Ohio House budget included $600 million in bonds for the Cleveland Browns. You all talked with Senator Bill Blessing about state funding for stadium projects. It sounds like he favors Governor DeWine's original approach. Talk to us about that.
He does. He favors reviving, and he is going to put forth an amendment reviving Governor DeWine's sports betting tax, which would almost be doubled under his plan to create a fund for all stadiums. So he said, I mean, so he realized that when the Browns were given $600 million by the the state house, and very quickly, a day later, the Cincinnati Bengals are asking for hundreds of millions. FC Cincinnati is asking for hundreds of millions. And there are many other teams in the state that also have stadium needs. And he said it's kind of spiraling out of control here. You know, we don't have this kind of money in the general fund to cover all of this. So he does favor Governor DeWine's proposal to use a fund created by all this extra state gambling tax money to address all these stadium needs. And he says it would give the state more control over how much money the teams are putting in, how long they're staying, how many concerts and events they're offering to the public outside of game days. So he does favor this, but there are other members of that Ohio Finance Committee who do not favor that, who do favor each team coming forward one at a time and asking for their individual ask, and they do favor bonds because some more conservative members of the Senate do not like raising taxes, period.
Dan, what have you all heard from the governor about this approach that the Ohio House took? I mean, $600 million in bonds, as I understand it, would cost the state $1 billion over the life of that debt. What's the governor saying about all this?
Well, the governor hinted but did not say that he would veto, portions of the House bill if it contains this $600 million for the Browns, or if it includes additional stadium money for the Bengals. What he told us was he just wants to make it clear that we don't have the money for this. He said, if you bond money that the Browns want, that's $1 billion over a period of 25 years. That's $25 to $45 million every year out of the budget. And we don't have that money. He said, there's a pathway for this stadium improvements to happen, but this is not the pathway.
Paula, you mentioned that FC Cincinnati is also asking for state funding, but FC Cincinnati stadium's already built and operating. How much is FC asking for, and what would the money help pay for?
Well, it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but it would be reimbursement for some of their construction costs for the stadium they've already built, and some of their construction costs related to their district that they're building. I don't believe Senator Blessing was really in favor of that as much as he was. He would like to see the stadium fund specifically for stadium infrastructure and not for these kind of associated entertainment districts. But, you know, the FC Cincinnati is also asking for hundreds of millions in construction costs as well. So, and I'm sure there are other teams out there that will be coming forward with their own asks. So this will be, you know, over the coming weeks up until late June, this will be in constant flux at the State House about what happens with this.
And late June, that's the deadline for getting a state budget passed?
June 30, yes.
June 30th. So, Dan, what, if any, impact will the state budget have on these lease negotiations between the team and the county? I mean, you mentioned that it looks there are lots of questions left to be answered. It appears that there's some progress being made because they've agreed on a price. There are some specifics they seem to be agreed upon. But, you know, is that the question of what happens with the state budget and funding for these stadiums, will that have a huge impact on how this all moves forward?
It could, because there's an out in that MOU document for, you know, either side to walk away if things aren't going the way they wanted to. But I think the fact that they put in writing that the team is willing to pay 120 and the county is willing to pay 64 for the first round of improvements, I think that's a positive indication that what we're talking about here is a renovation, and it's not going to be a new stadium. And the team and the county have a general idea of where they want to get to by 2029. So, you know, I think it's feasible that the team and the county could just proceed with that first phase, sign some kind of an extension of the lease, whether it be, a year or 2 years, or the Bengals have the right to unilaterally extend the lease for 2 years. So I think it's possible that they could, you know, do what they can now and then continue to lobby the state for the Bengals portion of funding if they're turned away at the state house for what they really want, which was, you know, $350 million toward their overall renovation.
We talked earlier about what this breakdown kind of looks like in this MOU in terms of what they hope the county would pay for, team would pay for, NFL would pay for, state would pay for. Paula, are there precedents in other communities for NFL teams to pay a larger share of the cost than what this memorandum of understanding would indicate?
Yeah, the general consensus now with these new stadium deals is, and I'm hearing this from lawmakers, is they want the teams themselves to contribute a larger portion of this cost than they do the local taxpayers. And especially here in Hamilton County, where, you know, we're still paying off the debt on the stadium. I mean, that the initial stadium debt's still not even paid for. So, you know, it is, you know, there is in other communities, the teams are paying more than a third. And that's, you know, I mean, that's a third with NFL help. So, I mean, theoretically, if a third comes from the team, a third comes from the state, and a third comes from the county, you know, the owners of the Bengals aren't paying a full third. You know, they are getting NFL help with some of that, and we'll have to repay that loan.
Well, I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporters Paula Christian and Dan Monk. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss us live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.